This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Poetry, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Yekir, your host. How one can speak about the past when the family don't have words to speak about it? How a person can speak about his or her history when the history comes from so many different places in the world? How a person identify as an Israeli when his family is from the Middle East, is from Iraq and from Kurdistan, and part of his family is from survivors of the Holocaust from Greece. And the person feels totally part of the Middle East. Today we will speak with Shachar Mario Mordechai, who is a poet, who was born in 1975 in Haifa, live in Tel Aviv. He published 4 volumes of poetry, which attracted critical attention. He was a poet in residence at John Hopkins University, Baltimore in Maryland for 2018 and 19. His books that we'll focus today, Tfos Makom LeGeshem, Make Room for the Rain, a poetry book that was published in the Pardes Publishing House in 2018. Won just now the first place in poetry by the Rachel and Leib Goldberg Foundation for 2021. The book was written in the United States when Mario lived for 2 years in Baltimore and 1 year in New York City. A personal note, this podcast, as some others that I published lately, is my try to bring voices from the Middle East, voices from Israel, Israeli voices, Palestinian voices. I want the listeners to have the ability to listen to the people themselves who are living there. I hope you enjoy.
Mario, thank you so much for joining us for the New Books Network. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Yekir, for inviting me.
So before we will start going deep through your poetry, as an Israeli poet, who lives for a few years in the United States, something that I'm thinking a lot is the place of translation. It's this hybrid identity between being an Israeli, but living in the United States, then going back, having one home, or maybe slowly becoming two homes, And I was thinking maybe we can start thinking about that by looking on your poem that focus on the task of translation. So maybe we can hear you, and then by that we can speak deeper about this hybrid identity.
Yes. So I'll read the poem on the task of translation. I'm reading it in English. It was originally written in Hebrew. And it was translated by Maayan Eitan. She's an author in Israel. On the task of translation. Try translating Arbeit macht frei. Work sets you free isn't quite enough. Try Endlösung. Is the final solution final enough? Once I watched a sitcom where a resident of Ahad Ha'am Street, come on, try, Ahad Ha'am, asked, what does it's a free country baby mean? And his neighbor replied, well, it's a free country baby. Laugh, laugh, but try translating the cry of my grandmother, Rosa Dante, over her sisters poisoned by gas, Matilda and Joya and Sarah and Susanna and their mother, Regina, in Auschwitz. Try translating Auschwitz. And do I translate because along came Mario, an Italian sailor, and led Dante out of Inferno before he was my grandfather, and Rosa my grandmother, and Europe hell? Translate gas chamber, but before, translate train, going without food or water for a week, no air, nor toilet. Did you? Look how nice this tragedy is translated into the history books. A treat for the professors of the 22nd century. Music to the students' ears, like a fable. I will not speak of Irving. And from time to time, this whole thing is translated into a historical discovery for the readers of Le Monde, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, on the breakfast table before leaving for another day at work or spending some time with the kids and the dog just a short while in the shady shaded area of Wendell Park, for example. But for my grandmother, Rosa, the discovery happened each and every hour and hour. Try translating.
Speak with me about translation and identity.
Well, the identity, I think, is very well rooted inside language. I think it was Amos Oz who said once upon a time that you do not really know your own language until you learn a different language, just like you do not really know your own country or your own city until you live in another city or another country. So the way our language works, I mean, Hebrew works differently when you compare it to English in so many terms. So the way, once you know another language, then do you understand the way your language works and how rooted you are inside that language. I think I read once upon a time that there were 70 words for snow by the Inuits, the Eskimos in Canada and North America in general. And but they don't have many words for desert. They have only one. But in Hebrew, you can have Midbar, Arava, Yeshimon, Tziyah, Chorava, so many words for desert because you can differentiate between different kinds of desert because it's rooted in the geography. So if you ask me about translation, then I think language is identity.
And then there is something in the poem that you touch or you try to translate not only the language, but also the feelings for things that I saw charged, right? Like Auschwitz or train, or even the names of your family who were taken to Auschwitz. And something there, it's really hard to translate it. So it's not only about the language, it's also about the culture as you connect them both. What should we do with that? What should we do when we go, you know, as Jews to the Holocaust and we try to make sense for something that doesn't make sense for us? How, for you as a poet, what do you try to do there?
Basically, I don't think I'm trying to do anything with that because I don't really understand the Holocaust. I don't think only those who were murdered there they can understand what happened, and we can't ask them. The fact is that I'm my grandmother Rosa. She was born in Rhodes in Greece under Italian rule. She was born there in 1912. And she met later on. She met Mario, my grandfather. He was Italian, and he was a Jewish Italian. He was working with the Italian ship as a sailor, and basically he saved my grandmother. He took her from before the Holocaust. He took her from Greece to Palestine, or to the British Palestine, and he saved her. Her family, like her mother, Regina, as I said in the poem, and her sisters, Sarah, Susanna, Joya, and Matilda, they were taken from Rhodes to Saloniki, from Saloniki to Auschwitz in Poland, and then they were executed, murdered. And I never met those people, and I never heard anything about those people from my own grandmother, she lived until the year 1998. She was pretty silent about that. So What can I say about her silence? What can I say about her feelings? I don't know much about that. But when as long as you get older and older, it's like it's like a tree that you're picking a fruit out of the tree, like insights. And then when you write the poem, you do get connected with your grandmother and with her family that she lost, and with her silence about building a new family, not mentioning the family that was left behind. And suddenly you understand things, and that's what poetry is all about, to open your eyes. By the way, the word poetry in Hebrew, shira, the meaning of poetry in Hebrew is seeing. We have in Hebrew the words shuru habitu ru'u. It means look, open your eyes. We have in the book of Job, Yov, the book of Job, he says, ayei fo tikvati v'tikvati mi yeshurena. Where is my hope, and who will see my hope? Tikvati mi yeshurena. Yeshurena is to will see it. Shur lachtzam ve'onyam in Hebrew means see their poverty and their troubles. Now in Hebrew you have La'uf and then le'ofef, lakum and then lekomem, lashur and then leshorer. I don't know if I can explain that, but lakum, it means to get up, to rise. But when you can lekomem, then you can make a rebellion and make other people wake up. And so lekomem is much stronger than lakum. And le'ofef is much stronger than la'uf, because la'uf is something that a bird needs to know. But But when a bird can fight the regime of winds and easily fly, it's leofef. It's more difficult to do, but much more leisurely. And leshorer is much more powerful than lashur, because lashur is to see. Leshorer is to make other people seeing, and from there comes the word shira, poetry. So what the poem that you asked me about, it made me see something about my grandmother. And once you read it, maybe I could open your eyes as well, opening the eyes of my reader or my readers. And that's what leshorer means, to write poetry in Hebrew.
So beautiful. It's so beautiful. And Mario, I'm thinking about that, how much your poetry is also about trying to see things that it's really hard to capture. And we will see later some of your poems around the life as an Israeli in America and what do we see there. But I still want to stay in the past, okay?
Yes.
Because it's not only that it's almost impossible to understand the life of your grandma, Regina, and but it's also happening with the generation just before you, with your father, because right. And I would love if we can maybe read the poem about the one who doesn't know how to ask. Maybe you can say something about the Jewish element of that, because it's a quotation from the Haggadah, the Passover Jewish Haggadah, the book yes. that we read. And then maybe we can read the poem and then speak about also our parents' generation, that something very deep happened to them, and it's really hard for us to capture.
Yes. Well, in the Haggadah, as you mentioned, Yakir, in the Haggadah of Passover, of Pesach, there are four different types of sons, four sons. Chacham, Rasha, Tam, Vesheino Yodea Lishol, the smart one, the evil one, the innocent or the naive one, and the one that does not know, doesn't know to ask. And the poem that you refer to is called Vesheino Yodea Lishol, the one that does not know how to ask. Let me see how it was translated, the one who doesn't know how to ask. Yes, it was translated by Lisa Katz. She's wonderful. And I don't know if it's, I'm talking about me who doesn't know how to ask my father about what happened to him, or it's my father who doesn't know how to ask. For your viewers and the listeners, I will explain. My father was born in 1947, and therefore in 1967, he was 20 years old, and 1967 is the Six-Day War. So he was a soldier in the Egyptian front in the Sinai Desert. And he was, the tank in which he was driving, it absorbed the direct blow by Egyptian heat. And then he caught on fire. My father caught fire and he was in flames. He was rescued from the burning tank and he was rushed to the hospital, the Soroka Hospital in Be'er Sheva, the city of Be'er Sheva. And he was back then in 1967 in 100% disabled, IDF disabled. Today he's 52% disabled because more than 50 years have passed and he is going through rehabilitation every year. So the percentage of disability is changing. So the poem talks about that, about my father, about what happened to him. And my father is, the relationship between me and my father are not that easy. I think my father, he's responsible to me being a poet because my father is not articulate. He doesn't, he cannot, it's like me in English, because in Hebrew I'm much more articulate, but like me in English, he cannot really complete a sentence. And it sometimes it takes him a minute, and a minute is a long time to complete a sentence. It drove me crazy when I was a child. Sometimes it still drives me crazy. So I think the fact that my father finds it difficult to express himself made me much more eager to be able to speak, to write, to be articulate with the surroundings.
And how much he speaks or he spoke with you about this war and what happened to him?
Only once, and it didn't go well. He was emotional. Obviously, I can understand that. So I spoke with his friend. His name is Gada Gidon. He lives now in Belgium. And I spoke with my mother. I asked a lot of questions about what happened to him. But I do not. It's something I should do, but I don't speak much about this with him because the one time that I did, it didn't go well.
So you need also translators for him by other people.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yes, thank you. Let's read the poem, please.
Yes. The one who doesn't know how to ask. In 1967, my father was 20 years old. It seems my grandmother, that is his mother, didn't know exactly when he was born. She gave birth to him, dark-skinned and black-haired, in Iraq, where records were not always kept, and if they were sometimes lost. My father remembers neither the Tigris nor the Euphrates of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah or Ali Baba. Papa was 20 and knew nothing on his exodus from Egypt, as it says in History of the Future, which I don't know if he ever read. If my grandfather had given a different date to the Israeli authorities, perhaps he wouldn't have been sent to the Egyptian front in the Six-Day War. And if he hadn't been sent, he wouldn't have absorbed the direct blow to the tank. And if he hadn't, my father wouldn't have been enveloped in flames. And if he hadn't, he wouldn't have lost his place on the Maccabi Haifa soccer team. And if he had continued to play soccer in Haifa, I wouldn't have been forced to play in his place, and I wouldn't hate soccer. And if I didn't hate it, he wouldn't have spoken to me in broken language and wouldn't have broken me. And I wouldn't have had to wear armor facing the burnt tank soldier known to me as my father. And at the age of 37, I wouldn't have asked Gideon, his friend called Gada from Belgium, to tell me about my father. And how one morning in that blazing summer of 67 at Soroka Hospital in Beersheba, when he didn't find him in the burn unit and called out his name, my father answered, "Gada, is that you?" And Gada said, "Mordecai, is that you?" One clawed at the air and the other stood in the air, covered the snowy white landscape that was the body bound in a thicket of impenetrable bandages, my father, a human being inside dense brush. And suddenly Gada tells me that I must understand. He brings to my understanding that my father is human, and I couldn't get enough of that.
Wow. It's so beautiful, and it's so hard. How, if we can't speak with our grandparents about the Holocaust, and we cannot speak with many of our parents about their, you know, grown up in Israel and the price of being there. Something very basic in us is silent.
Yes. I don't know if it's the same thing between parents and kids in America or in Europe. And I'm not sure that this is the same thing in Israel today between the generation of the parents and the teenagers of today. But obviously, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a barrier between parents in Israel and their kids, either those who went through the horrors of the Holocaust and came as survivors, and they couldn't speak about that to their children. And the silence at homes back then in the 50s and the 60s made an impact on the children. And the same goes for those who fought the wars in 1948, in 1956, in 1967. I think there was, and there still is, a barrier between those parents and their children, even though they're grown up today. The language is broken. Many did not want to hear the stories. Many did not want to share the stories. Many were haunted by the horrors. And I guess that today it's completely different, because today parents are much more friends. It's less parenting, it's more friendship. They listen to the same kind of music. Sometimes they read the same books and they go to the same concerts. But it wasn't like that in the past. And the rift between parents and kids was very much vivid back then in Israel.
There is another element, Mario, of the not knowing what to ask, because in a way you are asking many questions in this poem. Right? You ask, there is a beautiful prayer in the Haggadah or Piyut, in this Passover Haggadah. It's like, what would happen to the Israelites if this would not happen, if it not happen? But then, it's, let's say that God would take the Jews from Egypt, but didn't brought them to the Mount Sinai, right? And then if they brought to Mount Sinai, but they didn't get the Ten Commandments, et cetera, or didn't came to Palestine, to Israel. And you says if, and in a way the if for you is a wish, right? It's like, what if just your grandma would make another year when he was born, and then he will not be drafted to the IDF?
Right. Can you? That's the essence of Dayenu.
Yes.
Sorry?
Can you share a little bit about our wishes to create a different situation or a different kind of narrative inside Israel?
Yes, you mentioned the Dayenu prayer in Haggadah, and I used it in the poem that I read, because if it hadn't happened like this, then it would have happened differently. So Dayenu means it, that was good enough for me, for us. Yes, Absolutely. The way the political arena in Israel today is a question of what if. What if the Palestinians and the Israelis would have created a bond 100 years ago? We could have lived together side by side, the two nations, and have a prosperous beautiful land shared by the two of us, But so many mistakes were done by the politicians, by the nations, and look where we are now. So yes, exactly. That's the essence of the prayer from the Haggadah in Pesach Dayenu. But we take it right now. We make a copy paste from the Haggadah to 2021.
So Mario, I want to ask you. So it sounds and that from these two poems that one side of your family is from Greece and one part of your family is from Iraq.
Right.
And
My grandfather on my father's side was born in Baghdad in Iraq, and my grandmother on my father's side, she was born in Sulaymaniyah, which was back then a village. Today it's a city in northern Iraq. Basically, it's Kurdistan, Kurdish autonomy in North Iraq. So that's my father's side, half Iraqi, half Kurdish. And on my mother's side, yes, they're Greek and Italians, because Mario is Italian and Rosa is Greek. Even though she was born in Rhodes under Italian rule, but still it was Greece. It is Greece today. So yeah. So it's like Sephardic or Mizrahi Sephardic, because Spain, Italy, Greece, the Balkans is Sephardic Jews, and Iraqi Jews are Mizrahi Jews. So there is no Ashkenazi in my family, but yeah, I'm like mixture of Mizrahi and Sephardic.
I'm thinking about this side of your family, of your, like the side, the Iraqi side, because you mentioned that one of them was from the city, one of them is from Kurdistan, which is a fascinating Jewish community, what we call the Ashur community. They still speak Aramaic, Jewish right. Aramaic, right? But they also, I guess that they spoke Baghdadian Jewish Arabic, right? At home?
I visited in 2014, I went to the border between Turkey and Iraq.
Seriously?
There was, yes, and I was even invited by a TV crew to enter Iraq, but I was so much afraid that I didn't do that. They wanted me to come with them to Sulaymaniyah, the village of my grandmother, that is now a city, and they even told me that there is a street there called the Shar El Yahud, the street of the Jews. Now they speak Kurdish, also Arabic, Turkish. I spoke with them my Arabic, which I know a little bit of it, and I met an Assyrian priest. Basically, the Turks, when there was the Holocaust of the Armenians in the First World War in 1915, the Turks also massacred the Assyrians. But unlike the Jews and the Armenians, who have their own sovereign states, and that's why they have a lobby for their Holocaust, and their Holocaust is known in the world, the tragedy of the Holocaust of the Assyrians is not known. But the Assyrian priest whom I met, his alphabet is the Hebrew one. Basically, the Hebrews, they adopted the alphabet of the Assyrians. So he spoke to me like Aleph, Bot, Gomel, Dolet, which, and we say Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. It was very much alike. He even gave me a book written in Hebrew letters, but for him it's Assyrian's letter. Now, as the word Syria today, Syria is a Greek shibush. How do you say Greek?
Taken away.
Greek mistake from Assyria. Assyria is Ashur, and it became Syria. Just like some believe, I don't know if it's true, some believe that Lebanon is from the word Lavan in Hebrew, because the Hebrew tribes, they saw the white peaks of the mountains, and they called this land Lebanon, comes from Lavan, and Al-Urdun, Jordan, is because the river of the Jordan River is descending, is going down from the Sea of Galilee to the lowest point on the planet, which is the Dead Sea. So it's going down. And in Hebrew, Yarad, going down. Like in Arabic, it's Nazala. So the kingdom of Jordan, Al-Urdun, should have been called Al-Anzil, but they call themselves Al-Urdun, which is which is derived from Hebrew. And also some say that the word Misr, which is Egypt, because Egypt in Arabic is Misr, it's come from the word Meitzarim in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, because in Hebrew you have singular, plural, and you have a word for two, like one hand and one hand is Yadayim, one Mishkaf is Mishkafayim, the glasses, one Meitzar and one Meitzar, it's two straits, like two tongues of the sea going into the land, Meitzar and Meitzar is Mitzrayim. So Hebrew is very much rooted in the area, but Hebrew took the alphabet from the Assyrians. And when I met that Assyrian priest, I don't know why I'm drifted now with that story. I don't think it's connected to what you asked, but yeah, that Assyrian priest, it's which I met in, he gave me a book and I was so thrilled because it was written in Hebrew letters, which are not Hebrew for him, it's Assyrian.
Which I think it's very important because I think on the one hand, we see how much the life in for many Israelis is a life of multicultural. So many refugees from Europe, refugees from the Middle East. But when we don't have language, right? Because so many didn't speak. And even if they spoke in Arabic, in Jewish Arabic, in Turkish, in any kind of language. But in a way, there is something very important around the storytelling by the Hebrew language that hold, in a way, the roots of in the Middle East. It's like very native at the Middle East, the Hebrew, as you just mentioned about the different names. And I think that maybe by this connection between the language and the land, people feel at home. Or people feel that there is hope and maybe today we cannot communicate with our neighbors, but deep inside in the wording, in the narratives, as you mentioned, the Assyrian priest, which is one of the most old and ancient Christianity, right? Same about the Christianity inside Egypt, which is one of the very old one. And also with Islam, that so much is rooted in each other. And it led me to maybe the third poem that, and the last one that we will speak about our relationship with the Middle East. I would love if you can read for us your poem about Muhammad al-Bu'azizi. Yes. Maybe you can say something about the story, about why you choose to write about him.
Yes, just let me find, I found the point. Yeah, Muhammad al-Bu'azizi was a Tunisian vendor. He sold vegetables in his vendor in a small town in Tunisia. In December 2010, for the third time, the authorities in Tunisia, they banned him from, banned him from selling the vegetables, and he had to provide livelihood for his family. So after being abused by the authorities, he had enough and he set himself on fire. And that was December 2010. And back then there were many iPhones and cellular phones. So it was filmed and distributed in Tunisia. That was the trigger of the Arab Spring, the revolution in Tunisia, which later followed in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria, in Egypt. It brought the end of regimes in Egypt, in Libya, in Tunisia, and the civil war in Syria. Now, Muhammad Bouazizi, he set himself on fire in December 2010 and he died of his wounds in January 2011. He did it not because he wanted to die, he did it because he wanted to leave, but they didn't let him a fair option of leaving. I didn't know back then in 2011 in January why I was haunted by Muhammad Bouazizi, and he walked with me day after day, and I woke up with him in the morning and I went to sleep with him, and I became Muhammad Bouazizi myself, and I didn't know why. I wrote the poem in March 2011, like 2 or 3 months later, but and I wrote it within 7 minutes, something like that. But it wasn't really 7 minutes. It was 3 months of thinking about him and being him. And it took me a few years later to understand that I wrote about Muhammad Bouazizi only because of my father, because my father was on fire in 1967. Muhammad Bouazizi set himself on fire. You know, it sounds very logical to people, but I didn't really realize it when I wrote it in 2011. And yeah, so I'll read the poem.
Yes, please.
Muhammad Bouazizi. I am Muhammad Bouazizi. And even though I died and lived in Tunisia, in which I was crushed by the feet of dictators, I am telling you that Tunisia is a country in which you can raise your head if you want to. I myself thought that it cannot be. And I thought, as more and more years go by, it is less and less possible. How fool we were. A generation that got smarter in universities, but was not smart enough to raise its head on time. But I'm telling you, freedom is ignited from the most hidden and beautiful curve in our heart, from what we wear underneath our skin. And I'm telling you, if we change our future, we will also change the way in which our past is judged. Wake up, brothers, from Tunisia and Libya till Egypt and Syria. Don't be afraid of the near soil and the fire. Listen, I am Muhammad Bouazizi. I am dead and alive in this world of yours that is crushed by the feet of dictators. And I am telling you that there is no land in this world in which you cannot raise your head if you want to.
Wow. I can hear MLK in Hebrew.
It's a compliment. Thank you for that. Yeah.
It's MLK. So incredible. Like, I'm so happy that when I ask for your poems in English, the ones that you translated or friends translated, and you send this one, because I so want, and I think it's so important, like so many Israelis, I feel we want to speak with our neighbors. You know, you and me, we both had the gift to live for a few years in America. And one of the things that really amazed me by living in America is I was driving yesterday from Wisconsin to Pennsylvania, to Philly. It took us 17 hours or something like that. In Israel, you cannot drive over 4 hours, but I was thinking, Mario, what if we could drive for not 17 hours, 10 hours, my friend? We will cross Jordan, we will go to Iraq, to Syria, to Iraq. It's incredible. And I think there is such a deep wish for many Israelis that I meet to live with our neighbors and to speak with them and to be part of the Arab Spring, right. If we could, right? I don't know, I don't have the right words. Please hold these words and share where it touched you.
Yes. I share your dream, and it drives me crazy that we cannot cross the border and like drive freely and meet our neighbors. Basically, I think that there is a rift between the Israeli politicians and many Israelis like you and me, because the Israeli politicians, they face the West, they face Europe and North America, and they want to resemble North America and Europe. They don't want to be part of the Middle East. But many Israelis like you and me, we feel brotherhood with the nations of the Middle East, with the Palestinians, with the Iraqis, with the Egyptians, with the Jordanians, with the Lebanese, obviously, because the Lebanese are very much like us. But the barriers, the wars between us keep us apart. And I think that if only we had the chance to, because it happens sometimes that we do speak to our Arab brothers and neighbors, and we do find common ground. And we do find common grounds in our languages, because both languages, Arabic and Hebrew, are Semite, and I can call you Achi, my brother, and in Arabic, Achi. And I can tell you, Ta'al ala beti, come to my home, bite. It's the same word. And there are so much parallels between us, but our tragedy is the tragedy of the politicians on both sides. But since I'm in Israel, I will focus on the Israeli side, and I will tell you, and you know that the Israeli politicians, the Israeli leaders, they admire Europe and United States and Canada, and they want to resemble those countries. And it's fine. We have so much to learn from them, but we are rooted in the Middle East. We are part of the Middle East. We have to face our neighbors and be part of them. And sometimes we don't, it doesn't happen because we don't let it happen.
Wow. Thank you for that. And I want to do now a shift and to bring us to United States and to your years there when you are living in Baltimore, right? In Baltimore, Maryland. And you even wrote some poems in English. Right. How it is for you as an Israeli to write in English?
Surprisingly enough, it wasn't that difficult, but maybe because there is music inside my poems in Hebrew. The poems that I read translated, you couldn't sense that because they were translated, but there is a rhythm, there is music, there is correlation between the words and the rhythm inside my poetry. So therefore, I think that I was haunted also by the music in the English language, and I could find a way to write poems in English. Maybe, I don't know, maybe if I would have lived in Italy or in Egypt and I would have absorbed the Italian language or the Arabic language, the Egyptian dialect, I could have done the same. I'm not sure. Because English, you know, English we know from school, so we are familiar with English to a certain extent. But to answer your question, it was surprisingly enough that I didn't find it difficult to write immediately in English, but also because I wrote about the tension between whites and blacks, between African Americans and white Americans, and therefore it felt natural to write it in English.
Where you are when you come to America, so you pass as white, but I'm sure you don't feel white.
Right.
It's a fascinating position to be.
Yes, I think United States of America in general, but Baltimore in particular, they discovered Israel to me much more than they discovered America to me, because in Israel, I was stopped by police three times, once on the beach in Tel Aviv and twice in the street. On the beach in Tel Aviv, I took off my shirt and it was summer and I put it on my head. It looked like kafia. So immediately two policemen came to me and asked for my identity card. Identity card.
Yeah, ID card, yes.
Yes. And because they thought I'm Arab, and it made me understand a little bit better what it means to be Arab in Israel, in the state of Israel, because it's not easy at all. And the same happened to me twice in the street when I was stopped by policemen and they asked me to present the identity card because of my, I look like Arab. I feel Arab. I'm an Arab Jew. But when I came to the United States of America and I lived in Baltimore and I saw once again and again and again African-American people being pulled over while driving. I drove my car, others drove their car, and they were pulled over, but not me. Or in the street, I saw policemen approaching African-Americans, but never me. Nobody asked me anything. And suddenly I was in a different position. Because in Israel, the Mizrahi Jews are called blacks. Obviously, we're not black, obviously, but that's the terminology. The Ashkenazi Jews, those who came from Europe and the West are white, and those who came from Muslim states are black. And I'm a black Jew in Israel. But in the Baltimore taught me about how much racism there is in Israel itself. Not only in the United States of America, but also other stuff. Like I had in Baltimore, I lived in two different neighborhoods. The first year in Cross Country neighborhood, which is close to Pikesville, but it's still inside the city of Baltimore. The second year in Hampden, which is in the heart of the city of Baltimore. In Cross Country neighborhood, African Americans and Jews live together. And when I met a historian in a coffee shop in Baltimore and asked him how come it happened, he told me something that I thought it was a lie, but then I checked it out and it wasn't a lie. He told me about the redlining policy in the United States of America. Until the 70s of the 20th century, there was a redlining policy. There was a sociologist called John McKnight who termed that term. And it meant that there were some people didn't get services based on their ethnic background. I mean, African-Americans, Jews, indigenous, Indians, indigenous, and they were not allowed to live in the neighborhoods of the Christians, of the Protestants inside United States of America, which blew my mind because I had no idea it happened in Baltimore, also in Philadelphia, even in New York. And they didn't have, sometimes it was directly, sometimes it was selectively, like insurance, banking services, supermarkets, apartments. So that's why Jews and African Americans live together in many neighborhoods in Baltimore. And one time an African American neighbor came to me when I came back from work. I parked my car and I get out. I always, when I was working at school, I had a yarmulke, a kippah, but I always took it off. When I went out of the car, there was no yarmulke on me. And he asked me, "Are you Jewish?" And I said, "Yes," but I was very vigilant because I said, "Why is he asking me that?" Yeah. And he said, "I envy you." And I immediately said, you know, like brainwashed. I said, "Why would you be envying? Being Jewish is not easy. You know, Holocaust, persecutions, Inquisition." And then he said to me something, Yakir, which really, I wouldn't exaggerate saying that it's changed my life, that it's changed my perspective.
Yeah.
He said, "You guys have 3,000 years of documented history. You know where your forefathers came from. You know if they came from Egypt, from Babylon, from Europe, from Persia." He said, "I don't know where my forefathers came from in Africa." Mm-hmm. There is no documented history. Nobody wrote where they came from inside Africa, which country, which state, and if they were Muslims or Christians or even Jews. So I don't have roots. And it's a very simple truth, but it never crossed my mind until this African-American neighbor told me that, and it shook me. It happened a few years ago, and I think I will never forget that. So,
It's incredible. It's incredible what you said, because as you said, at least in the Jewish tradition, we have what to rely on. It's like the storytelling. It's so important, right? And I think this is why it's hard for us when, I don't know, your parents don't share the story about the war or the trauma. They share it by the trauma. But at least even if we don't have the language about, you know, the generation of the Holocaust, we have the thousands of years of storytelling that we can hold and be connected if we are connected to our Jewish, I would not say tradition, but Jewish culture, Jewish or the Hebrew culture. And there is so tragedy when we say like African-American, and many Black people tell me like, but we don't have the connection to the roots in Africa. And so let's start diving into your poetry in your life in Baltimore. And can we start with Fall Winter 2016-17?
Yes.
Thank you. And anyway, I would just mention these coming poems you wrote in English.
Right, in English.
And you even in your book, which is a poetry book in Hebrew, that you didn't translate it to Hebrew. It's in English.
Right. Originally in English, and yes, Fall Winter 2016-2017. The cool air felt good on my face. The trees were wet from the dew, and I knew it wasn't my place. The land looked tired or aged. Autumn had walked in and seen how things changed. Pack up and leave before the deep fall. Most men don't do it on time. Time does it to people. The air is colder every day. The trees drip with the dew. And I knew.
Say more.
Say again, excuse me?
Can you please say more about this feeling? Because it's such a, as an immigrant also from Israel to America, I so understand what you talk about. It's the feeling of not belonging and the question of belonging.
Right. First of all, you could see in that poem that there is rhythm and there are rhymes in English. Originally, it was written in English. And that's what I meant before, that it was easier for me to write in English, surprisingly, because in Hebrew, I do the same, even though it doesn't go through in the translation. Yes, to your question, when I arrived in the United States of America in September 2016, the first few months were difficult for me. I didn't find myself in the United States of America. I wanted to go back to Israel. I'm happy that I didn't go back to Israel and I stayed for the whole 3 years, because it enriched me. My experience was amazing. But the longing for Israel and Israeli culture was very vivid. And also the September 2016, I arrived, I wrote that after the elections in which Donald Trump won. And it made me sad, because I understood that that wasn't my place, because I understood that the new, back then, new president has values that do not coincide with my values. So I wouldn't say depression, but the sadness of being away from my country and inside a country that chose, the, in my eyes, then the wrong president, then I wrote that poem. Yeah.
So I wonder a little bit, because a lot of your poems also speak in your book, it speaks about the relationship with nature. And right. I wonder how much nature, since nature, it's, let's be honest, it's not, there is no American or Israeli or Palestinian nature. Nature is nature. I wonder how much nature is a place that you create relationship with. But also, you know, the United States nature, it's so different in a way from the natures that we know in the Middle East. Can you speak right. a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think that the most dramatic thing that happened to humanity in general is not the point at which we discovered nature, but the point in which we got used to nature and then disregarded nature and ignored nature and then exploited nature and took advantage of nature and ruined nature for our own purposes. But eventually now we see the ramifications of that, because we are ruining the planet. So the state of Israel and Palestine are it's a small piece of land. You said it yourself, you can drive 4 hours and then you reach a border. Sometimes you can drive 1 hour and you reach a border. If you live in Haifa and you go to the north, it doesn't take long until you reach the Lebanese border or the Syrian border. It's not the same in the United States of America, as you know, or even if you want to cross the border to Canada, you can do it easily. So you can drive for 17 hours. Of course, you have to rest in the middle, and you are exposed to different kind of nature. Like when I, in 2017, when I took a road trip to the 6 states of New England in the fall, and I saw the leaves, the red leaves, the yellow leaves, the gold leaves, and it ignited the roads, it ignited the rivers, it made everything was on fire. I don't have such foliage. That's how you say it in English. I don't have such foliage in Israel. So it haunted me. It fascinated me. And when I drove to, I think, the most beautiful place, as far as I know, in the United States of America, is Glacier Park in Montana. Mm-hmm. Because in July, August 2019, just before I moved back to Israel, I made a road trip coast to coast from Maryland in the east to Seattle, the state of Washington in the west. And then when I arrived in Montana, I went to Glacier. And Only those who were in Glacier know what I'm talking about. It's fascinating. It's beautiful. It's amazing. And, you know, I had to write about it.
Yeah, yes, 100%. So I want to ask you to read for us now two poems about your meeting with race and racism in Baltimore. I was thinking maybe we can read first both poems from page 70 and 71, Dig Through the Wall, and Michael Schwerner. Yes. And then I want to learn from you about like how your narrative and like how much what you see in America is familiar for you as an Israeli, as you mentioned a little bit, but also maybe it's different. And there is also this deep relationship between Michael Schwerner and the Jewish community as a minority, as you mentioned. So maybe let's read it and then we will speak about these two poems.
Yes.
Toda, Mario. Thank you.
Toda lecha. Thank you. Dig Through the Wall, the first poem. It's about Freddie Gray. Would you like me to start reading or just explain who Freddie Gray was?
Say who Freddie Gray for our non-Americans or people here who doesn't know.
Yes. So Freddie Gray was a 25-year-old man. He was arrested in 2015 by six policemen in Baltimore. He was a Baltimorean. And he was arrested for holding a small knife. Later on, it turned out that he didn't hold that knife. He was bashed with his head on the police car, and there is the marks of bashing his head. And then the six policemen, they handcuffed him and took him to the police car, but they didn't give him the seat belt. So what happened was a rough ride. There is that's the terminology in the US, rough ride. That means driving very, very fast without a seatbelt. It doesn't leave a lot of chances for the poor guy. They drove for 45 minutes, even though the police station was only 3 minutes away from the place in which they arrested him. But after 45 minutes, they arrived at the police station and he was a vegetarian. That's how you say?
Vegetable.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was rushed to hospital and he died 7 days later. And then there were the what the white Americans would say the riots, because the black community in Baltimore was so upset. But I wouldn't call it riots. I mean that's the terminology that's the wrong terminology. So I wrote about Freddie Gray, Dig Through the Wall. Hold your head higher, above the rest of our dead, above the narrative of the empire. Higher, Freddy, hold your head. Drop your feet down to the floor from cold table made of steel. People died like you before, due to color. They do still. History books will wash the stain without your voice in the protocol. Lives like ours washed to the drain. Come on, Freddy, dig through the wall. The dead are more than we can number. We need one to escape the grave. Dig through the wall, raise your head higher. Tell the story, Freddie Gray. Wow. That's what you said earlier about telling the story.
It's the only thing we can do. Right?
Yeah.
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 Who is Michael Schwerner?
Michael Schwerner was a Jewish American guy from New York. He was 24 years old. He was in 1964 or in ahead of the elections. The elections in every 4 years. He tried to help African Americans in the South to vote because people in the South didn't help them voting. They tried to prevent them from voting. There were three guys, Michael Schwerner, Goodman, and James Cheney. Two of them were Jews and one of them was African American, and they drove all the way from New York to Mississippi in order to help the African American community to be able to vote. And they were arrested by the by Cecil Price. He was the deputy sheriff. in Mississippi or in Alabama, I think in Mississippi. And when he let them free, they didn't know that he was part of the Ku Klux Klan, the deputy sheriff, and he and his gang, they stopped them again, and this time they murdered them. They murdered the two Jews by a bullet to their heart. It was, if I can say, clean death.
Yeah.
But the African American James Chaney, they tortured him for hours because of his color, and so his death was horrific. When I told you that in 2017 I drove to New England, to all the six states, and when I arrived in Massachusetts, I went into the Museum of Norman Rockwell. I didn't know much about Norman Rockwell, even though he's very popular in American art, because I'm not that familiar with America. And then inside the museum of his home, probably in Massachusetts, I saw many paintings. Some of them were about the African American history, and I saw the painting of James Chaney being tortured, and I didn't understand what I'm seeing. I read the subtitles, and then I Googled, and then I made, I investigated, and I found out all the details. It broke my heart, obviously. Also, I was proud of Michael Schwerner. Today, I don't think that there is a cooperation between Jews in America and African Americans. Today there is a rift, I think, between the two communities, if I understand it correctly. But back then in the 60s, there was a cooperation between the two minorities, the Jews and the African Americans. I was so proud of Michael Schwerner, because what he did, even though it cost him with his life, and he triggered the two laws, the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Thanks to them, thanks to those three, wow. It happened.
Yeah, so let's read Michael Schwerner.
Yes. Dear Michael, on 21st June 1964, the summer began and you died with James Chaney and Andrew Goodman. How far could you see in that blue Ford? The summer skies embraced you through the trees. Later, the windows were rolled up by the deputy sheriff. There was a good breeze. Michael, my brother, it should have been a freedom summer. James drove the Ford station wagon to Mississippi, only to get nowhere. One bullet struck Andrew, second bullet struck you. James died slower. Did you notice, Mikey, you were born on the election day that Lincoln won? Did it cross your mind in that blue Ford that the day you'd turn 73, you could see someone like James win a second presidency? But your last memory is seeing Goodman's soul as it leaves and the deputy sheriff in KKK disguise. Later, under a tree, beaten to death, James could see the upper leaves and the summer skies.
Mario, it's, I wonder, you know, I hear Billie Holiday's Strange Fruits. I wonder what's happened when you read these poems to Americans?
I read it only once to Americans. That was in Johns Hopkins University. Mm-hmm. I would say they were shocked too. I don't know if they were shocked by the poems. They were shocked by the stories, by what I told them, by the revelations for me, and maybe also for them. I'm not sure that Americans are very much familiar with that, let's say, ancient history, even though it's not ancient at all. But again, in Hopkins University, when I spoke with the students, there was a debate after reading those poems, and you could see that the debate was between, I would say, white people and black people. It was heartbreaking to see. There was a lot of understanding between them. Not that there wasn't, but there was a debate. And it was emotional on one side and less emotional on the other side. I'm trying to be precise with my words and gentle. It also taught me a lesson about what happens in America. Baltimore, by the way, the city in which I lived is the biggest city in Maryland. It's not, the capital is Annapolis, but the biggest city is Baltimore. Maryland is one of the economically established states among the states of the United States of America. There are 16% Americans under poverty line in the United States of America, but in Maryland, only 10% under poverty line. So Maryland is a better situation than US, but in Baltimore itself, 23% of the population is under the poverty line. Baltimore is a very neglected city. And when I lived there, I could see in Israel, there is a word called haslala. I don't know if there is such a word in English, like when the authorities pave your way in order to make sure that you get less good education, less good welfare system or health system. Like that's what we say in Israel about the Mizrahi Jews, that they were Muslalim. I could see that in Baltimore when it comes to the African-American community, that the authorities paved the way intentionally so that they would be poor.
So we're coming to the end. And I want to end with, if it's okay, with one of the poems it still speaks about the questions of race in America, but it also brings your deep Jewish tradition, because it's a prayer. It's end with a prayer from the priests. They pray, and Jews like to bless the Israelites, the Jews. And actually, in every morning, right, in the morning prayer in Shacharit, we say it. I would love if we can end with the hope, with hope. So can you read for us, please? Again, this is going to be translation from Hebrew to English. The yes. title is in English, Green Book, but the poem itself is in Hebrew.
Yes, the poem is in Hebrew, as you said, and I'll read the translation. I hope I'll read it well, because sometimes I make mistakes. Green Book. One question. Let's say you have to drive all the way between New York and New Orleans. Where will you stop for gas? Where will you spend the night? Where will you grab something to eat if the year is 1962 and you are black? Two. Answer. Victor Hugo was born in New York 7 years after his death in Paris. Victor Hugo Green compiled a guide for the non-white traveler so they can be saved from every enemy and ambush and from robbers and wild beasts on the trip and from all kinds of punishments that rage and come for every American Cosette or Jean Valjean. May God make his face shine upon them and be gracious to them. May God lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. I hope I read it right.
It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful prayer. And also, of course, you quote from the prayer that many Jews, they say when they travel, right? The Birkat HaDerech.
Right. That's Birkat HaDerech, yes. Before you travel, you pray that prayer. So God will shine for you and nothing wrong will happen to you on the way. Yes.
Shachar, what a gift to have you on the New Books. And thank you so much for writing Make Room for the Rain by the Pardes Publishing House. Thank you for joining us.
Yakir, thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure, and I hope I'll see you.
Amen.